Good evening, my name is Ron and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ron.
Thank you, Larry, for a very nice introduction. I remember when you walked through that door and it's what helped and what continues to help that meeting survive, you know. It's wonderful. I think we've had about three newcomers get sober with Longue Nooners. Tuesday and Thursday, St. Clair Church, at noon. And I'd like to say hi to all our friends out there in cyberspace. This is quite an honor. I remember that in the beginning, those online meetings were actually quite helpful to me because living in the South Shore, there was no CA there, you know, and I joined a couple of CA groups online, and I was I got hooked after a while, you know, because I was going down there, and it was a big book study and stuff. It was really nice, and so I'm all for that, you know. And there's a lot of suffering alcoholics out there that get on their computers and have great stuff to share. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm kind of really grateful to be in recovery. I guess on that kind of journey, you know, that roller coaster ride of ups and downs and dealing with all of life. And thank God, I realized that there's really nothing that can get for today that has given me a reason to drink again, in order to do drugs again. And a lot of bad shit too, you know, that I realized that, hey, wait a minute, I used to drink for 10% of what's going on in my life, you know. We don't need an excuse to drink. We're alcoholics, you know. I think we just need the booze and that's it. I used to drink for any reason, you know. I was happy, sad. And it all started, I think, when I was a lot younger, like probably 10 years old or so, when I used to see the effect it had on people. So I had the effect of alcohol before even taking my first drink because I really envied what it was doing to what it would do to people. Mind you, I didn't see tragic things happen, but I remember the impression it would leave on me when I would see people drunk and having a good time and everybody kind of standing around being entertained, you know. And I thought, that's the way I want to be, you know. Although I became a professional entertainer, you know, it was kind of the story sort of has this thing where I pretended to be drunk, you know, and got drunk, and then later on pretended not to be drunk. So thrill was a big problem too when I was growing up. I used to feel like there was the boring everyday life that I had. And the thrill of what I could imagine, what I could fantasize, that would make things a lot more exciting, you know. So I used to fabricate all these scenarios in my head. My grandfather used to have me go to the fridge and grab him a beer and open the beer, and when I was very young, and he would let me take a little sip, and naturally I don't remember the effect of that little sip. There wasn't enough really to have an effect, but just the effect of the thrill of doing that, you know. Was kind of very significant, and I was to carry on. It still is today like that, you know. We have this kind of addiction to thrill before using anything to any substance to enhance it, you know, or to make it real. I always associated booze with getting drunk. You know, as a teenager, like all those little parties we used to have and carnival time and this and that, you know, I guess in a sense, I don't think I was an alcoholic back then, but I associated booze with getting drunk, you know, like if there was a party, if there was booze around, then I would drink and I would always cross the line with it. Whether it was at family affairs, weddings, or just friendly parties. That's the reason that alcohol exists for me, is to get a buzz, you know, and no other. And the social aspect of drinking for me started, I suppose, when, because I'm a professional musician, and when I started in the music business at a fairly young age, like 18 or 19 years old, I was still in university, and working with a lot of older musicians, and the booze is very much part of the lifestyle, goes with the territory when you're a musician, especially when you're working in clubs and stuff, and working in wedding situations, you know, where there's an open bar and stuff like that. And I remember arriving at one of my first gigs where the band leader said, okay, son, take your horn out of your case, set up, and then go to the bar, get a drink. We're going to start in 20 minutes, you know. So I figured, wow, you know, this is going to be fun. This is going to be a hell of a career, you know. It sort of continued like that. I mean, being accepted and being, you know, it was the thing to do. It was always to go out for a drink after, or to drink during, or to meet for a beer before, or on every break, or, you know, whatever. And, you know, I was young. I was living at home, and still had basically no responsibilities, you know, doing all kinds of work in the music business, like studios and television and tours, and, you know, going around the world and playing jazz festivals and all kinds of stuff. And I'm living at home. I have no responsibilities. I have no expenses to pay, you know. I was able to start saving my money, you know. And at the same time, my father didn't want any money from me, you know. And I said, look, Dad, I said, I'm making a lot of money. I'd like to at least pay you some kind of a board or something. He says, no, as long as you're living under my roof, you know. When you save your money, because one day you're going to get married, you're going to have a family and all this. You know? I said, well, okay. I negotiated for $100 a month, you know, so and which he put aside into an account for me anyway, and gave it back to me one day. But, you know, arriving home very late every night, and, you know, in a tuxedo, and, you know, the white shirt is hung and dry and back in the closet before you even get out of bed the next day at the crack of noon, you know. So kind of spoiled, you know. I had a very loving family. I can't say that there were any problems at home, any reasons for me at home to overindulge, you know. It was just basically this kind of party, work hard, play hard kind of philosophy that I had with all the people around me. Like, we were all growing up together musically and with my friends, and we would all go out and party. But then at one point I crossed the line, because I had this double life happening, you know. It didn't just end with the social side of it, you know, working and drinking and then going home, going to sleep, you know. I had developed the isolation part of alcoholism very, very young, and I needed to kind of develop a very intimate relationship with that, in that I would go home and I would continue the drinking down in the basement. You know, this would be after being out all night with my friends or working or whatever. Discovering drugs too in the mid 80s was another enhancer that sort of went hand in hand with the booze. And I had developed a ritual, you know, like things like, okay, well, we're going to go out and we're going to meet at this bar, and we're going to do, you know, do a jam session, and then we're going to go into the can, and we're going to split some dope up and this and that. We're going to have a good time, and oh yeah, that's fine, you know. But it was always a case where I knew that I wanted my own stuff, you know, to hold on to, and I knew that I had more booze waiting at home, and it was like, okay, now I got to go, you know. What, you're going so soon, you know? Yeah, I got to go, I got to get up early tomorrow morning, you know. So the lies started with my own friends, and the lies because I needed my isolation, I needed to do my ritual at home, you know, with the dope and with the booze down in the basement while the parents are sleeping upstairs, you know. And I'm into my early to mid-20s by then, you know. I realized back then, and I'm going back now, you know, I'm going to be, how old am I going to be? I'm going to be 47 next week. So I'm going back, you know, like over 20 years ago. And at one point I was aware of the fact that, hey, I think I'm headed for a problem here, you know, because it seems to be my life here. I'm just living for the fact that, okay, I'm going to get stoned again today, you know. I'm going to drink again today, and where's the next party going to be, you know? If it's not going to be on a gig, it's going to be at a sports bar on St. Michel Boulevard with my Italian friends, you know, playing pool and smoking a joint and having a few beers and going to hang out at this other place after. So the nights off were party, and the nights working were party. So every day became a party. And I sort of had this philosophy that, you know, I've got no responsibility. I was always trying to justify, you know, I've got no responsibilities. I'm not married. I don't have a girlfriend. I don't have a family. So, you know, now's the time for me to do these things while I'm young. You know, now's the time for me to party. Because then, you know, when I do get married and when I do have children, you know, then I'm gonna be serious, and you know, at least I'll get this out of the way now. You know, needless to say, when that day did come, where and it was ridiculous because it was this thing where I'd be down in the basement, and I'd have, you know, like the TV Times there on the coffee table, covering a couple of lines of Coke, you know, and then I'd have the basement window open with a pipe, you know, filled with hash or pot. And then the booth was in the bar with the door closed, and the beer bottle the chaser was behind the couch. So there was no evidence. You know, if any family member got up in the middle of the night, you know, at 5 in the morning, you know, and came downstairs in the basement, everything's normal, I'm watching TV. Now, what the hell are you watching TV at 5 o'clock? So I'd have this thing that would take me about maybe 10 seconds to do, you know, where I would lift the TV Times, do a line, run to the window, take a couple of puffs of my pipe, you know, run to the bar, grab a bottle, take a power swig out of it, close it, shut the door, run back to the couch, reach for the beer bottle, take a sip, put it down, cross my legs, you know, and that was like the ritual. And 5 minutes later, do the same thing, you know. Sick. But I got myself into that thing. It just catches up to you, you know, it just creeps up on you and you realize you're doing it. And I started realizing that I was doing it and saying, geez, what's going on, you know? Something's got to happen to me sooner or later. You know, I was asking myself questions. Until the phone rang and some pretty lady called me up and said, would you like to go out with me sometime? And I said, yes. And that was 19 years ago, and we're still together. And the funny thing is that I remember saying, wow, you know, I have a girlfriend now. Now, this is what I wanted, you know, and this is what I needed, and now it's going to get me serious, and it's going to get me straight, and I won't have to do this thing anymore, you know. So now there was but that double life now had grabbed me by the balls, excuse the expression, and it continued. So I had, you know, now I was managing, you know, managing the career, managing the girlfriend, you know, and then managing my other intimate relationship that I had, you know, which was to become probably the most intimate relationship that I'll ever have, you know. So they say about addiction, you know. And the same thing was happening now, you know. We moved in together 2 years later, and this was like in 88, and the same thing was happening in my own house this time, you know, going down to the basement, you know, doing my ritual in the basement. Those damn basements, you know, maybe even. But all along, you know, I'm realizing that, wait a minute, now I think I have another problem, and the problem is that I don't seem to be satisfied with anything in my life, regardless of how great things are, you know, that sort of that people, places, and things syndrome, you know, where, okay, I've got the girlfriend now, but maybe that's not good enough, You know, maybe there's something better than that, you know. I see her over there. I think I'd be better off with her, you know. Or I don't like this house, you know. I think we'd be better off in a nicer house, you know. So there's always bigger and better things, you know. Regardless of how people were telling me that I was successful, and regardless of how people were telling me I was talented and all this, I always felt inadequate, you know. I always felt like, you don't know what you're talking about, you know. Remember reading an entry I have in the Encyclopedia of Music for Canada, and I said, who's the idiot that wrote this, you know? Not willing to accept a compliment, not willing to accept a compliment from someone, you know. It's always this, ah, come on, you know. I don't know what you call that, you know, insecurity maybe, fear, you know. All the isms are there for me. When I started reading the Big Book, I freaked out, you know, because I basically saw myself in those opening chapters. It got worse and worse. I stopped paying bills. I was, you know, just to fast forward a little bit, I was hanging out in bars that, you know, I mean, in a tuxedo, you know, and like seediest parts of town, and dealers all over town, and I was kiting bank machine. You know, I would not pay my bills, toss them all into the back seat. I had an American Express card. It was the only means I had left for funds, where I would just put maybe $5 of gas in my car and at a time, so that I always leave room for more gas, so that I can get my cigarettes and beer at one of those gas stations that had dépanneurs, you know, and put it all on American Express card. I'd have, so that whatever cash I had was for the machines. I wouldn't even want to put a quarter in a parking meter, because that was for the 5-cent Keno, you know. So I had this addiction with the VLT machines too, in bars. So I had my thing happening with the beer bottle, the line of coke, and the machines, you know, and that was my mistress, so to speak. Never wanting to be home. You know, always finding an excuse not to be home, you know. Sitting at home watching TV, do we need anything at Provigo, you know? Yes, as a matter of fact, we need this or that, or do we need anything at Jean Couture? Okay, I'll be right back, you know. So I'd have to get out of the house, and I'd have to go to see a dealer close by. I'd have to grab a couple of beers, because it was getting to that point where I don't want to see you drinking so much at home, you know. I said, okay. So we cooled it at home, have one beer, you know, but a bottle of frozen vodka in the freezer, so that when she'd get up to go to the bathroom, I'd run to the kitchen and take a swig of the frozen vodka, you know. Anyhow, I mean, I could go on with a lot of little things like that, but it's Christmas time. I heard a speaker this morning at my home group of Tashiro talk about his whole life story, and he was going on and on and on quite a bit, and I'm sitting there, and I couldn't really identify with anything he was saying, but I knew that in the end, the convergence would happen, and that's why we're all here. It's because there is this convergence, you know, regardless of our backgrounds, regardless of where we come from, regardless of our stories, it's that disease that brings us together, you know, and the recovery process is very important and very significant that keeps us sober. So and he was going on about all kinds of stuff, like, you know, where he lived and this town, these big jobs and these huge jobs that he had, and houses and cars, fancy cars and all this stuff. But he was an alcoholic, you know, and he ended up in AA. I got to the point where physically I became a diabetic. Because I was down to about 145 pounds, and I used to be 205 pounds at one point. I wasn't eating. I wasn't eating well, you know, and I love to cook. I'm a great cook, you know. It's like food's not important anymore. Love's not important anymore, you know. When you see you have all this unconditional love around you and you're taking it for granted, you know. And you'd really so bloody self-centered that you don't really give a shit about anybody anymore, anything. And everything that you have to do that has responsibility attached to it is just in the way, you know. It's in the way of what of your sickness, you know. In the way of the ugliness that you feel drawn towards. So I mean, part of the whole bottom idea is just, you know. I've heard people say this before, and I say, yeah, me too. You know, is not even being able to look at yourself in the mirror anymore. You know. What have I become? Like, how come I ended up this way? You know, what happened to that really nice guy that you know that everybody likes so much? And so you start to really feel bad, you know, financially disaster, spiritually a disaster. I didn't even know what that meant, you know. I mean, I was stoned and drunk in so many situations that, you know, family situation. I'm starting to avoid my family because I knew that I would rather be out getting high, you know, than to be at my sister's for dinner, you know, or whatever, you know, or my grandmother's or something like that, or my mother. I started to confess to my mother that I had a problem. And so naturally she was concerned. I was, I never told my sister. Of course my girlfriend knew. She was confronting me on several occasions and I would always threaten, you know. If you leave me, I'll commit suicide. I remember saying that once. What a sick thing, you know. If you leave me, I'll commit suicide. You know. Whew. When I think back at that. Anyhow. I called up the Griffith Edwards Addictions Unit once, and they were at the Montreal General Hospital, and I got that number through a friend of mine who's a doctor. And I called them up, and they suggested that I go in for an interview, but there was a three-week waiting list, you know. And I said, I can't wait 3 weeks. I'm going to die. At this point, I had lost control, you know. Not going to bed at night, literally hoping that, you know, I won't. If I don't wake up tomorrow morning, I don't mind that much, you know, because I couldn't. I had a hard time seeing myself get through another day, you know, just managing, you know. 11:30 in the morning, I knew that there was, you know, I could get started at the tavern near my house before going to teach my first class. I mean, I teach at two universities, you know, you know, I would have I would even organize my schedule so that I would teach my first student at, 12:30, 1 o'clock, knowing that it's going to give me time to go to the tavern that opens at 11:30 with the Dieter showing up there and getting started, you know, and showing up late several times because I would be at the machines, you know, and it's 12:15, and I have to get up to University of Montreal now, you know, from Longueuil. And how many times trucks were overturned on the Jacques Cartier Bridge, you know, the lies, you know. Mm-hmm. And I would have to remember which one did I use last week, you know. The Victoria Bridge was jammed, you know, all kinds of stuff. Denver boot in front of my own house, that was a classic. First name basis with the bailiffs, that was another classic too, you know. They took me in and I started going to this twice a week thing. It lasted 3 weeks because I was failing all the urine tests. I didn't study hard enough, I guess. But they threw me out, you know, and they said the only option you have now is detox. And the psychiatrist told me that the chances of me recovering were highly unlikely, you know. because of the long-term use of cocaine and drinking and stuff. So I found that to be like a little bit drastic, you know. And still, you're still in denial saying, well, it's not that bad, you know. And so I went to detox. I got into detox on November the 2nd, 1998. And so I just took my seven-year cake last month. And so I'm about to start my, spend my eighth sober Christmas. Detox was a hell of a shocker, but it was a relief at the same time, you know, because I knew I was protected, because there was nothing was working for me before that. You know, I was going to priests, and I was going to a couple of meetings here and there. You know, I was even using the meetings as an excuse to get out of the house. You know, I'm going to go to one of those meetings. Oh, great, wonderful, dear. I'm proud of you. You're going to be okay. You know. So I would go to the meeting, but I would get stoned before. I'd go to the meeting, enter halfway through the meeting, sit, just so that I can hear a few words, and then sneak out and go back home and say, wow, what a great meeting. The guy was talking about this, this, and that. You know, I always had to cover my ass, you know. It's like when I would leave to go to Jean Couture, I would get the Q-tips. You know, I'd come home with the Q-tips. You know, but meanwhile, the double life all the time. The double life, the lies. I entered detox, and it was there really that I had to, you know, I was starting to write. I couldn't sleep anymore. I mean, they were giving me some Valiums and stuff the first few days, and I wasn't sleeping. I was staying up all night, and I was writing, smoking, and just trying to think about what the hell happened to me. How did I end up here? You know, it was something that I said I would never do. I would never take myself. I remember promising myself that I'll never bring myself to that point where I'm going to have to go to a rehab or go into detox. You know, I'll be okay. You know, and it just happened so fast. You know, like oof. Next thing you know, it's sort of like, oof, you wake up and you realize, where am I here? I'm in detox, you know. I went to the Foster Pavilion 6-week outpatient program. And in the first week there, I had what I call a closure slip, which was like a one-hour slip. I had enough cash from some gigs to go to a friend of mine and say, here, I want you to go to this place and that place and that place and pay these guys off for me, you know, had some debts to pay. And he said, yeah, okay. He says, I'll go later today, you know. So on the way home, I just decided to turn into to my old tavern there, and that I hadn't, at that point, I'd gone maybe 3 weeks without having a drink or a drug. And I said, well, if there's any time at all that I'm ever going to have a beer or have a line of coke or play a machine again, it's going to be right now. And I want to see what it feels like after 3 weeks of not doing it, you know. And I turned into the tavern. I walked in. I said, hi. I got a little line of coke. I got a draft. And I had about 30, 40 bucks in my pocket. At that point, we had agreed for me not to have any money, just a little bit of an allowance. And all my gigs, I would bring it's like kind of the Italian parents, you know, doing that, bringing the check home to the wife, and she's paying all the bills. So that was a good protection, you know. No more cards or anything. So, but I had this cash that was in my pocket, and of course I had to go out and do that. The last drunk on November 2nd had been like a gram of coke and a bottle of vodka, you know, that afternoon. And I never finished the coke. It was the first time that I had never finished a line of coke, because I passed out at my neighbor's place when I was taking out the garbage to hide the empty vodka bottle. She saw how rough shape I was in, you know, so she took me in her house, you know, and I passed out on her couch, blacked out. My last drunk was my first blackout. Anyhow, I started going to, and the thing is, I never told anybody about that slip until 4 years later, you know. told my sponsor and I told another couple of AA friends. I said, you know, I said, I have something to tell you guys. My sobriety date is November 27th. It's not November 4th. Because I didn't want that to be a big deal, you know. I did that little thing for 1 hour, and I went home, I took a shower, and I had a nap. And I said, you know what? I could just go right out, back out there again, and what for, you know. I realized that I had been that much stronger to control it, but at the same time, now I knew what that whole craving thing was all about, you know, that I had been experiencing before, and that how easily it would be to start up again, you know. So that was kind of a spiritual awakening, I would say. It's funny to say how a slip can become a spiritual awakening, but I didn't quite see it as a slip, you know. It was intentional, an intentional closure. So thank God it didn't develop into anything else. I started coming to meetings. I started joining groups. In the first week, I was going crazy, joining every group. I joined 3 groups in 1 week. Nobody said, no, you just have to join 1 group. But it kept me going back the week after, because I felt now responsible. I felt I was part of something, you know, I belonged to something, so I have to go to that meeting because I joined it, you know. So it was a nice kind of responsibility, psychologically. The steps, I wasn't quite paying attention to the tools yet, but I was stricken by the fellowship, you know, making new friends immediately. All these new people that were not musicians, these people that were not in my domain, you know, and that we had very similar problems. Of course, it helped me to realize that I wasn't as unique as I thought I was, you know, that the disease makes us all the same, you know, and all the people that are in the room, that I used to think I was so special, you know, that I, you know, my problems were not like anybody else's problems, you know. Yeah, the grass is always greener. That I struggle with that all the time, and I realize that it's as green as it's going to get, you know. And to be grateful and to appreciate what I have in my life, which is a damn good life. It's a great career. There's a lot of love. I have the ability now to give love, give as much love as I want to, you know. I heard a speaker share about 4 months or so into sobriety, and he was to become my sponsor, and he still is today. And he told a story that was my story, and which I found very amusing, and the recovery part was great. He was about 4 years, I guess, 3-4 years sober at that point, and he was going on and on about God's will and the third step, and how everything is fine in his life, as long as he turns his will over to God, you know. And I wanted to understand that more, and I said, would you be my sponsor? He says, yes. And he said, call me tomorrow. So I called him up the next day. I remember being in the basement, my basement, you know, and pacing around. He says, grab your big book. And I grabbed my big book, and he says, open it up to page 63. And I'm like this with the wireless arm. I said, okay. And I'm pacing around. It took me a long time to come down, you know. I guess, you know, cocaine addict, you know. And I still tend to get speedy sometimes, you know. I don't know. He says, open it up to page 63 and recite the third step prayer to me, you know. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may better do your will. He says, you understand that? I says, well, I would like to. But I says, what's God's will? He says, doesn't matter. He says, you make that decision. I says, yes, I make the decision right now. He says, get on your knees. I says, okay, I'll get on my knees. So I'm on my knees in the basement. And read that prayer again. He says, memorize it. And say it over and over again every day, you know. And he says, you'll see. Things will happen. Trust it. So I did. You know, I was out walking my dog every morning, saying the third step prayer over and over again. I had it memorized. The serenity prayer. The seventh step prayer. So I was covering all of that stuff. I was trying to stay in touch with these prayers as closely as possible so that I developed an intimate relationship with prayer, you know, to replace the drugs, to replace all of that, the stuff that was manifesting the disease. And a couple of months later, I'm in the Provigo parking lot, just to close here, and I'm in this parking lot that does not have those stalls to put the baskets in, you see, and I always used to just leave it there next to the car, you know, and take off, you know. I didn't give a shit. And on this particular day, I went to my car and I opened the trunk and I shoved the groceries in. And I took the basket and I just nonchalantly went back to the front of the store and I left it there, you know, where it was supposed to be. And I went back into my car. And it was the moment where I got back into my car and closed the door and started my car. I realized I had just done that. But I hadn't realized that I was doing it at the time. I just did it. And I realized it was after the fact. And I said, wow, you know, that wasn't me that just did that. You know, could this be that third step prayer thing happening, you know, where you kind of just automatically you're drawn to doing the right thing. And that started, that triggered a whole bunch of stuff, you know, little stuff like not even wanting to throw a cigarette paper out the window anymore, you know, putting it in my pocket. It's just like crazy. I phoned my sponsor, I said, Ian, I have to tell you something that just happened to me. He says, okay, you got it now. You know? So that's basically the way it works, a very simple, corny little story like that. And that can mean a lot when you have that kind of spiritual awakening and realize, well, okay, that's the way it is. As long as I try and, you know, stay in a straight line and do the right thing, I'm doing my best, you know, to give as much love as I can, to be as helpful to others as I can, to be good to myself as well, too, you know, and not try to stray from myself by overindulging too much in other things. And trust that whatever happens to me and whatever happens around me is God's will for me, you know, as long as I have that faith. Lots of good things have happened. Lots of bad things have happened. But the good things are great. I mean, the bad things are I have to look as positively as I can and say, well, okay, this is a sign for something else that needs to be done in my life. Or this is going to change. The reality of this situation is going to change me a certain way for the better. It's the only way I can explain it. Whether it's death, or, you know, mishaps. But the good stuff is great. I'm doing a master's. I'm finishing my master's this year, you know, in music. So that's really good stuff. All of the activities that I've gotten into in AA have helped me tremendously. I'm the DCM now for the District 7 in the Central. Organized a convention for a few years, too. That was great. So I would strongly suggest service, you know, to keep you connected. I've been to meetings all over, you know, Newfoundland and London, England and Mexico and stuff like that. And it's that new, like I was saying, it's that new intimate relationship now I have with the program and with the fellowship and with sobriety, you know, and keeping sobriety first above everything else, you know. After 7 years of sobriety, of course, there are those days that we feel a little more complacent, you know. But it's good to be aware of that and realize, oh, wait a minute now. Well, I'm a little discontent about this, or I'm a little irritated, or I'm annoyed, you know. And you kind of do this little quick tune-up in your head and say, well, okay, here's that, the self-centeredness coming back here, you know. Like I say, I'm grateful to be here, and I thank you, Larry, for asking me. And I wish you all a great holiday, safe and sober holiday. And thank you.
We should have been there. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Ron. I being a co-